Sorry, I was having a weird cat situation.
Okay.
That was like I was very distracted by a cat scratching my door.
That'll happen. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my co-host from San Diego, California, Keith Foster.
Whoa. Am I official? I'm not friend of the show. I'm not guest.
I'm officially going to pass the baton. We had Richard on last week, so we have closure there.
So my power moves worked.
Your power move worked. And this is the part where you introduce who I am.
Oh, yeah. Cassidy Robinson from L.A.
Yeah. I like you had to think about that. Like, we haven't known each other since sixth grade. You're like, who am I talking to again?
Yeah. It doesn't matter.
Today, we're going to be reviewing The Founder, the McDonald's biopic. And then for our Netflix homework, we'll be talking about Richard Iotti's The Double. How have you been? How's you been your week?
Oh man, it's been a rough week for the nation as it bleeds and weeps. Globally not great, but locally just fine. Tonight in San Diego, came back last night. We had our big premiere. We rented out a different venue. We were at the Music Box, which was like a cool music venue downtown.
Mm-hmm.
The whole place was filled up. Audience was awesome. And this is our first episode that's going to air on the CW6.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
What's your time slot?
Saturday nights at 11. So we're competing with the SNL rerun.
Yes, you are. That's not bad, though. I mean, that's like something somebody would actually watch. It's not like Sunday at 3 a.m.
Yeah, it's like a legitimate time slot. Mm-hmm. And then... like the day after we announced that we're going to be on the CW6, CW announced that their parent company got bought by CBS. So there's a little up in the air, but I think we'll be okay.
Yeah. As long as if they do just do like a clean sweep and they're like, we want everything that you're showing.
Yeah. I mean, during that time slot, they were showing 2 hours of Tosh.0.
Yeah.
So now they're just showing 1 hour reruns of Tosh.0. So I think we're okay. It's not like a highly sought after time slot.
I like the idea though that there's that guy who's like really committed to watching those two episodes of Tosh.0. Like that's his wind down every Saturday night.
Yeah.
And then he's like, what the fuck is this? Bullshit.
Well, I guess the CW affiliate, I guess this one airs in LA as well, because we're like the CW affiliate for Southern California. So
I could watch you on my TV, maybe.
I think so.
If I have that channel, yeah. I'll have to ask.
There's always YouTube. What about you?
I've been Concert Palooza lately.
Yeah?
Which is kind of redundant to say since Palooza has to do with a music festival, but I didn't go to a music festival, but I have been going to a lot of shows, as it were. A few weeks ago, I saw like a little small indie band at a skate shop in Orange County that held roughly 60 people shoulder to shoulder.
I'm into it.
Called Mom Jeans.
That's a pretty great bad name.
Yeah, it works. It works for what they're doing. And that was fun. It was one of those $5 things. You know, there was no way to actually buy the tickets online. You actually had to pay at the door. And then just this last weekend on Friday, I went to a show at the Echo in Echo Park, an all-girl punk rock band called Kaitana. I think I've told you about them. They're fun.
Okay.
They were the opening act. So was Mom Jeans, for that matter. And I think we left both times before the main act started playing.
That's I actually went to a concert as well.
Mm-hmm.
Ashley and I went and saw Jeff Bridges at the Belly Up.
Like playing music?
Yeah, yeah. Which I don't really know his music. We mostly just went to see Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was like the day after the Woman March.
Sure.
You know, he came out and so he plays country music.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he did Jeff that Bridges. Movie Crazy Heart.
Yeah. Jeff Bridges and the Abiders. Not Abiters, Abiders, like the dude abides.
I got you.
Yeah. And so it's country music, right?
Right.
So we get there, and we got there, I thought, early.
Mm-hmm.
So you and I went to a concert there a few months ago, mm-hmm. where we got there way early and it was empty. But we got there early, and Jeff Bridges attracts a very different crowd than the Dandy Warhols.
I would imagine so. Was there anybody there under 60?
No. And they were all there early. So we hadn't eaten or anything. So we got there early trying to get a seat so we could get some food,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just kind of sit back and enjoy the show. But it was like the AARP field trip night or something. Because all of the tables were taken by old people. And so it's all old people, all country music.
Uh-huh.
And so I kind of forgot, you know, that we were in California and it's super liberal and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so Jeff Bridges comes out and immediately is talking about, like, the Women's March and stuff. And everybody's super into it. And I'm just like... It's just another reason I'm glad I live in California. And just like I was getting like this weird Idaho conservative anxiety that I didn't need.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we couldn't find a seat. So we had to eat standing up, which kind of sucked. It was really crowded.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, we weren't even really there for the music. So we only heard him play a couple songs and then we left.
Did you go for free, I hope?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm supposed to say that, but...
Yeah, I mean, you have ways, but yeah, yeah. I was like, that would be kind of a bummer if you paid, like, whatever exorbitant amount.
No, yeah, I had a friend who gave us tickets, so, mm-hmm. You know, it was just a cool experience. We got to see sure. Jeff Bridges, that was fun.
Was there for your consideration going on with that concert? Because Hell and High Water has been nominated.
No, he was just totally like fun and just into like music and hanging out with people. Like I saw him take pictures with people. Mm-hmm. People I know were at the show who took pictures with him after and stuff. So I think he was just like, he doesn't do it for the money.
No,
he doesn't, you know, he's not living off his Abiders cash. But it made me really want to rewatch The Big Lebowski. So I rewatched that this last week, too.
Oh, okay. Well, you don't need a lot of good excuses to do that.
No, it's pretty great.
That's pretty fun whenever. Yeah. Saturday night, I went to another concert. Back-to-back, saw Kaitana at the Echo on Friday, and then on Saturday, by myself, I saw the Doom Stoner band Sleep. And opening for them was the Melvins.
Oh, nice.
Who play here kind of often because they live in California now. And, you know, I've never seen either band before. And obviously I know who the Melvins are and everything. But I've never seen them live. And I like those guys still do it. Like they're like nice. Well into their 50s and they like musically have not aged a day. And
all right.
Like, you know, Buzz Osborne is wearing like a wizard's gown or something with like giant eyeballs on it. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. And then Sleep was just like, you know, being assaulted by waves and waves of droning guitar, which is exactly why I went.
Well, yeah. I mean, a band like the Melvins, they do it because they love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of like Jeff Bridges and his Abiders.
You know, that wouldn't be the weirdest pairing of all time if they ended up like in a band together.
Yeah, okay. And like I said, I didn't know much of his music, but and I'm not that into country, but it was like kind of this old, like Western campfire country. Sure. So the couple songs we heard, I was pretty into.
Dead People Country. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The best kind. If you've never seen Crazy Heart, I vaguely suggest it. It's more like a performance movie than anything else, but it, you know, it's all right.
All right. I mean, he won an Oscar for it, so it can't be terrible.
No, yeah, he's very good in it. Let's go ahead and actually start talking about movies. Let's get into the movie news.
Sure.
We've kind of backed up on this, and
yeah,
I hope you're sitting for this.
Uh oh.
This sentence makes absolutely no sense to me.
Okay.
There it is. Will Smith may headline Tim Burton's live-action Dumbo movie. I'll repeat that. Will Smith may headline Tim Burton's live-action Dumbo movie.
I know all those words.
Doesn't that sound like it was like mad-libbed?
Yeah.
So here's the thing. Tim Burton and Disney have had a long-standing relationship.
Yeah.
I mean, at least since it kind of goes really far back if you count his animation days when he like animated on Fox and the Hound and shit before he went off on his own, and then he did Frankenweenie for them, and then he did his own thing for a little while, came back for Nightmare Before Christmas, and now they do those like shitty Alice in Wonderland things.
I mean, I can't imagine this will be any better. Like, it already, like, even just that sentence is a mess.
Yeah.
Like, is Will Smith Dumbo?
Playing the actual Dumbo?
Is it, like, a voice thing? Or is he going to be, like, the weird, cool, like, circus guy? Or, like, what Will Smith are we getting?
It says here on the article, the Birth, Movies, Death article that I'm reading it from, it says, Disney is circling with Will Smith to star for director Tim Burton's Dumbo, the live-action adaptation of the classic 1941 animated film. The studio is moving aggressively towards a production start with the script by Aaron Kruger about the big, lovable elephant.
So if he's starring, that means he's Dumbo, right?
I mean, I guess.
Or it will be a drastically different interpretation where Dumbo has like a cool human sidekick. Which could, I mean, look, okay, we're talking Tim Burton, we're talking
right,
weird Disney remake. For all we know, Dumbo's his war elephant that he'll ride into fantasy battle against the Mad Hatter.
Right, because everything has to have a battle in it for some reason.
Yeah. We'll get the fantasy epic version of Dumbo.
You remember that there's a joke, probably ad-libbed, in Independence Day where he's like joking around with Vivica Fox, and she says something about his Dumbo ears. You remember that?
No, I don't remember that.
And then he's like, hey, your chicken legs. You don't remember that? When he's about to go fly off and fight the aliens. Yeah, I don't
know. Well, now he'll fly off and fight the aliens as an elephant.
What if it's like a Julie Taymor style, like, like Lion King situation where he's like on stilts and has like the suggestion or a gesture of a trunk?
Yeah, I think that might actually make it
cardboard armor.
Yeah, I think that might make me more into it, actually, because I'd be like, okay, at least they're, like, doing something different. It's not all CGI, and, I mean, it's weird, but...
I'm willing to bet that he is going to not play Dumbo. If I were to put my money on it, I would say that he's probably is going to be some sort of human cipher character that they shove in. To make it work.
Yeah,
he'll probably work at the circus or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I just feel like if you're spending money to get Will Smith, you don't want Will Smith to be an elephant.
Right.
My first story is a little bit of DC Universe news. Mm-hmm. A couple things here. I'll just throw them together. First is that David Goyer and Justin Rhodes are to head the Green Lantern Corps movie for DC. Mm-hmm. And then the next is that Ben Affleck is no longer directing The Batman.
Right. So I assume he's probably still going to star in it because he's already starred in the Justice League movie that's already wrapped, I think.
Yeah, my guess is that, I don't know, that his whole thing with Batman is weird because this isn't the first time they've said he's not directing it, but then he said he was definitely directing it. It's like they're trying to release too much information before movie even exists.
What I'm willing to bet is that there was a negotiation thing going on and he was using the press as leverage.
Yeah, maybe.
To create kind of a buzz around him maybe dropping out. If people said, oh, you can't get rid of Ben Affleck, he's going to make it so good, then he could say, see, they're going to go see it because of me, so you better give me more money.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were doing that too, which is kind of funny how quickly people put their faith in Batfleck. Because, well, I mean, it was a joke when he was announced, and then, you know, arguably most people would say he's the best thing in Batman v Superman.
Damning with faint praise. The way I feel about it, and I feel probably a lot of people feel about it, is that, say whatever you like about Ben Affleck the actor, he's a pretty good director, and he's a pretty solid director. I mean, he's an Oscar-nominated director at this point.
Yeah, I don't know. Live by Night got pretty lukewarm reviews.
Yeah, but
And maybe that has something to do with this, because maybe. I think it was kind of set up to be more of a prestige picture, right? And then
Live by Night or Batman?
Live by Night.
Yeah, I think it didn't happen quite like that. It ended up getting pushed late.
He was trying to leverage that somehow.
No, I you know, it could just be projects didn't work out. Who knows, really? But
I really think it's just that DC gets ahead of themselves. They want to release information to keep the hype train moving. Mm-hmm. But they haven't perfected the art like Marvel. But even Marvel releases information way too soon.
Right.
And then stuff changes and then they have to address it. You know, like the whole Inhumans mess.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. But anyway, I would have liked to have seen his take on Batman, because I think, like, if you look at something like The Town, that's a noir, you know, it's a cops and robbers kind of thing. There's a lot of Heat influence on it, as there was on The Dark Knight, so that could have worked. People like Gone Baby Gone, I haven't seen it. Argo's pretty good. So I think actually he's a stronger director than we've seen work on these DCU movies so far.
That's true.
Certainly stronger than as far as like being able to tell a coherent story, certainly stronger than Zack Snyder.
Well, yeah.
And he might have been able to ground it a little bit. So we'll see what it ends up being. It makes me vastly less interested in whatever it's going to be at this point.
And he probably has the clout to make it, you know, mm-hmm. or did have the clout to kind of make it a little bit more his movie than a studio thing. But
right.
I don't know. I just, with these superhero movies, as much as I love them, I try not to get too invested in every announcement that comes out.
Yeah, same here.
Stuff changes so much. Yeah. You know, same thing with the Green Lantern Corps. David Goyer, who will probably be involved because, you know, DC just has a hard-on for David Goyer.
Yeah, and I don't know why.
Yeah, he's usually, you know, competent at best.
Mm. I think he's kind of a hack, personally. But
I kind of agree.
I like a couple of the Blade movies. And I think Christopher Nolan and Jonathan Nolan were able to kind of work in spite of him for mm-hmm. most of their Batman movies. But his work otherwise is fairly not good.
Yeah, I'm not super into David Goyer. I think
the stuff that annoys me about those movies, I usually attribute to David Goyer's bad writing. Like a lot of the stuff that annoys me about Batman Begins.
Yeah.
But I don't know who Justin Rhodes is, but I didn't know that are they just going straight to Green Lantern Corps? Are they going to try and do another Green Lantern movie first?
Well, again, this is one of those movie rumor things that, so they announced it's going to be Green Lantern Corps, and they're, from what I can gather, it sounds like they're, they're presenting it as a team movie instead of an individual superhero movie,
yeah,
which I think is a smart move. You know, setting Green Lantern up as his own standalone hero didn't really work with Ryan Reynolds. It was a terrible movie. So, take it in a different direction.
Yeah.
But you gotta, I just don't know that David Goyer is the guy to write a cohesive team story.
Mm. Yeah, I would have liked to have seen Geoff Johns or somebody like that work with him, or, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, like, I agree. I don't know who Justin Rhodes is, but I think someone a little more vetted. I don't know. A Green Lantern movie could be cool. A Green Lantern Corps movie, sorry, to be specific.
Yeah.
I think it has potential, but I don't know. DC, same with Batman. They haven't given me a lot to really hope for.
To get super excited about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's see if you're excited about my next news story.
Okay.
Finally, a remake that makes sense. There's so many remakes all the time. Oh,
I guess?
No. there's so many remakes all the time, none of which are like movies that people really cared about all that much in the first place. Or they're so lauded, they have such a filmic history that it's like sacrosanct, and it's like, why are they remaking this anyway?
Uh-huh.
But this one is exactly right. Every Which Way But Loose is getting a remake.
Okay.
I'll repeat that. Every Which Way But Loose.
No, I heard you.
The Clint Eastwood movie with him and an orangutan is getting a remake.
Okay. I never saw that, so I don't I don't really care. I mean, I don't know. Did you see this? Is it?
Yeah, like on like Spike TV or something, when, you know, like off and on, like not really. And it might have been that or the sequel, Every Which Way But Can.
That just literally goes to show you that they don't have any original movies anymore.
No.
If they're,
well,
going,
I mean,
back
obviously I was being facetious with my setup there. Who is clamoring for this? Who is this for?
Some movie producer that looked at how much Every Which Way But Loose made the year it came out, tried to figure out what that would be for inflation with a celebrity attached.
Yeah.
And is like, yeah, I'm sure we could churn this out for pretty cheap. Why not?
Okay. Oh, this one's fun, though. This is a fun game. Who is today's Clint Eastwood of that era who could, like, who's kind of grizzled and it would be funny to see him act beside an ape? But, like, it's a little outside of his wheelhouse.
You know who it's
going to
be, right? It'll be? Hashtag give it to Gosling.
I'm feeling it. That was what I was going
to
say.
Hashtag give it to Gosling. It makes sense.
It does, but also, but Gosling is a little, like, he does comedies.
Yeah. Which, like, makes it even more appropriate. He's, you know, he's got the comedic chat. I don't think they'd cast him based on the irony. I think irony casting died with Jack Nicholson and Anger Management.
Sure.
I just don't think it really works anymore.
Yeah.
You just can't cast actors based solely on their reputation anymore. So, Ryan Gosling. If Ryan Gosling spends 2 hours with an orangutan, I'll see that movie.
You'll see Ryan Gosling and an orangutan.
Yeah.
Directed by, it's going to be James Fargo, who I don't know. Oh, no, James Fargo was the original director. He came on as a producer, so there's that.
So maybe that's who it's for.
There's just one person alone.
Yeah, he's just like
he's living his weird Sunset Boulevard, like, existence where he doesn't realize, like, cinema's changed a lot since 1978, and, like, movies about truckers with apes are not really what's happening anymore.
Yeah, you know what? The more we're talking this out, the more I really am getting excited for this.
Well, we'll see if it does well enough or captures America's attention enough to make the sequel as well.
Yeah.
70s were a weird time. What was your other story?
My other story is that so Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett's Good Omens book is getting a mini series adaptation produced by Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
I this is one of the few books I've read to completion, actually.
Like, in your life?
Yeah.
Like, I've read that book.
Yeah. No, I did. I actually really enjoyed it. It's very funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's got Neil Gaiman's sense of, like, urban fantasy with Terry Pratchett's sense of, you know, fantasy comedy.
Right.
It's about the end of the world. Mm-hmm. So appropriate for this time.
Sure.
And yeah, so it's being produced by Amazon, and I guess, BBC is co-producing it. That makes sense given the source material.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this sounds cool. I like Neil Gaiman. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Depends on where you are.
Yeah. But yeah, it was a really funny book. My only problem with TV adaptations of books, and this is why I'm kind of hesitant,
mm-hmm.
is so it's sort of the inverse of movie adaptations of books. Movie adaptations of books have to cut stuff out, so they mm-hmm. have to write around plot points. Whereas TV show adaptations have to fill stuff for, you know, a full season.
Mm-hmm.
So they make stuff up, and that's weird. If it's going to be an actual miniseries, which the fact that BBC's producing it is a good sign, I think,
mm-hmm.
Then hopefully we kind of get just a truthful adaptation, and it's not too much filler garbage. Yeah, so that's my big thoughts on it, is like, let's just see the book play out and not worry about making it a TV show.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, I never read the book. I kind of know its reputation, and
it's funny.
It kind of came out around the same time, correct me if I'm wrong, kind of around the same time as Preacher, and they share some similarities as far as this kind of like look at the celestial mythologies,
kind of
this, like, and like reinterpreting mythologies as sort of a farce and that kind of stuff. Even like
postmodern take of the Bible as fantasy versus mm-hmm. Holy scripture.
Yeah.
I think it was in the 90s when it came out.
Around
the same time. It's not as dark and fucked up as Preacher, but it is kind of like, you know, there's dramatic moments, there's high fantasy moments, but mm-hmm. then there's a lot of humor as well.
Right. So I'm kind of like Dogma as well in that sense.
Yeah, actually, I think Dogma is a pretty good comparison, except, yeah. You know, like, different.
Right, all slackery and 90s-y.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'd be interested in seeing it, especially given the people behind it. I think BBC, you know, not too long ago, BBC was kind of seen as, like, you know, Doctor Who was popular amongst a certain kind of nerd. Red Dwarf was popular among a certain type of nerd.
I feel like this is getting personal.
It's not. I mean, we have a case study in common, but you know, like it was very niche audience kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I have the DVD set for the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe BBC series from the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Like when the guy was dressed as like a beaver in like a giant carpet beaver suit.
The budget they're working with.
Yeah, I feel like they're able to, like, with even like low grade CGI, they're able to do a little bit more now. And they're able to, I think the writers kind of are a little bit smarter about what they can do production wise and what they can't, and to let the actors really drive the shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a big part of why Doctor Who is so popular.
Right.
Is that it's, they're very clever scripts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if they kind of go in that direction, I think it could be pretty cool.
Yeah. I think it's funny that you compare it to Preacher, because I watched some of the TV adaptation of Preacher, and it's exactly what I was talking about, where they, like, fill all this weird stuff in that I really didn't think they needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they definitely wrote it for TV, which I decided I'm not into, because Preacher is just its own thing. But yeah. I think Good Omens is the type of property that could, you know, probably be very entertaining.
And if it's a miniseries, then, you know, they can commit to 6 to 12 episodes and then call it a night. Whereas with Preacher, they're going to want to go seasons and seasons and seasons. And there's a lot of material there for them to do that. But, I mean,
which
I don't
know. Like, why not use it then? Mm-hmm. Why not use it?
So, well, that's exactly what they did with Walking Dead. They, like, it's more inspired by the idea of the comic than actually, like,
yeah, you know,
using
I'm
any
I'm
of the story beats
that.
At work.
I'm not into that. I liked the comic for a reason. I don't need the comic to continue on in TV form. It's like the American Gods, which is also by Neil Gaiman, got picked
HBO
up by Starz.
HBO is doing that, right?
Starz, that's which right. Yeah. I might have a little more faith in it if it was HBO. I definitely want to watch it, but I'm kind of skeptical about that one just based off of things I've seen and read about it.
Fair enough.
Good Omens will give a chance.
Yeah, I'd be willing to see an episode or two. Yeah. And if it's on Amazon Prime, I'll actually be able to.
Yeah, that is a benefit.
Let's go ahead and get into the reviews for the week. And why don't you set up The Founder? What is that movie about? What's going on?
So The Founder is the story of Ray Kroc, a struggling salesman. He's peddling sort of these inventions across the country to various diners. Then he comes across a diner that is a game changer called McDonald's. It's
San Bernardino, California.
Yeah, it's not a drive-in. It's you walk up, you order, and you have your food in 30 seconds or less. And it blows his mind. And he decides that he's got to have a piece of this restaurant. He joins up with the McDonald's brothers. Slowly and systematically, we see this little walk-up diner become the multi-billion-dollar restaurant chain that it is today.
Yep. Michael Keaton plays the lead. Nick Offerman and John Carroll Lynch play the McDonald's brothers opposite him. And then we also have some cameos in there and some, you know, supporting performances from Linda Cardellini. I'm always pro Linda Cardellini because we see so very little of her.
Also, Laura Freaks and Dern. Geeks. I'm
Laura Dern.
Pro.
Yep. Pro the great Laura Dern. And BJ Novak has a small part there and Patrick Wilson.
Yeah.
What did you think of The Founder?
I kind of had mixed feelings about it. It was okay. Like the cast is great. You know, I could watch Michael Keaton all day, day, every day. I love Michael Keaton. But the story itself, I felt a little duped. Because at first it's very much like setting you up on Ray Kroc's side, and then it like slowly shows you all of the bullshit he does to basically steal their company, their name, their literal name. And I don't know. I guess I wanted the movie to take more of a point of view on that. I wanted it to kind of dig its teeth in a little more. I felt like this could have been, you know, kind of a pretty exposing movie on the evils that, you know, could the evil potential of capitalism. Especially what's going on with the current political climate.
Right.
I wanted it to be, because there's almost a moment where there's like sort of a dramatic turn for Ray Kroc, for Michael Keaton's character. But I feel like it never really gets there. I feel like the movie's kind of a little too obsessed with telling the McDonald's story to really be an effective character piece.
Yeah, I think it struggles between the two. And I think the best stuff in the movie is the character stuff.
Yeah.
Because the cast is so good. I should say this is directed by John Lee Hancock, who's a Workman's director, does kind of crowd pleasing type stuff like The Blind Side and Saving Mr. Banks.
Yeah, and that's That's what this felt like. Was
yeah.
Like I want to. I would have loved to see like David Fincher's version of this movie.
Well, sure, that would have been The Social Network, which is one of its many reference points. I think it wants to be a little bit of that. I think it flirts with something like The Big Short as far as its messaging goes, its anti-corporate message. But I think that ultimately the movie is.
It just plays it too safe.
It definitely plays it too safe, and I wonder if there's a if there might be more to it than just. I wonder if there's actually like something politically going on with the movie and its association with McDonald's, because it's telling the actual story. It's not like, you know, Jack Donald's or something. Like it's the story of McDonald's are using real names and everything. And they want to paint this guy as this kind of Zuckerberg, you know, Fincher Zuckerberg kind of Machiavellian asshole kind of guy. But at the same time, they also want to sort of glorify this sort of the bootstraps, like,
yeah,
from ground, from nothing. Like, look at this corporation take off the way it is. And then there's like obvious kind of moments of food porn that almost look like they're just commercializing
McDonald's
food. Like, I 100% went and ate McDonald's right after the movie.
I really wanted to, but I didn't. Like, if you watch just the first 20 minutes, then yeah, you'll have to get McDonald's. But by the end of it, I was like sort of so disgusted by what Ray Kroc does.
Okay,
that I'm like, I really don't want to support McDonald's, actually.
So the anti-corporate thing kind of worked a little bit for you. I didn't buy it. I thought that they sidestepped that so much, even though they really try and turn him into a bad guy. I think they try, especially with the McDonald's brothers.
Well, there's that old saying of show, don't tell.
Mm-hmm.
This movie was interesting to me because they were definitely telling something different than they were showing.
Yes.
Like they were trying to glorify it and make him sort of redeemable, but literally we see him steal every idea he's ever had. And I think the closest the movie comes to that is the end shot, which is like parallel to the beginning shot, which I was like, okay, that's actually pretty clever, where he steals the speech from that record.
Right, right.
And I wanted more of that.
Yeah, that's also a not so clever reference to Raging Bull.
Oh, okay.
Which, Paul Thomas Anderson already stole when he did Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
So, I mean, movies beget movies, and certain scenes are iconic for a reason, and sometimes you can kind of cleverly play them. I think Paul Thomas Anderson did that a little bit more cleverly than John Lee Hancock does with this movie. It's interesting that you say show, don't tell. I think the movie is so chock-a-block with exposition and needless exposition. I wrote in my review that, like, the screenplay by Robert Siegel, he, like, holds our hand through every single thing. There is no ambiguity as far as whose motives are what.
Oh,
what,
absolutely.
Like, you know, like, they go into these long diatribes about, like, well, let's tell you, like, how we started the company. And then it's like, we came up with this process. And he said, well, what, this part isn't going to work. So I had to change that up. And, like, these speeches that just, like, they almost kind of sort of work because the movie has this, like, I also wrote this kind of Norman Rockwell kind of G-golly
precious quality. That's what I mean. Like, I wanted there to be, David Lynch also could have done this because he was, you know, he had that obsession with, like,
1950s like the Blue Velvet. Americana.
Yeah. David Lynch, yeah, I think could have really said something with this. But, my wife specifically brought that same thing up with the part where he, like, comes back to the McDonald's brothers after driving around his hometown. And he sees the arches, and he's driving around his town, and he sees the flag and the cross on the church. Mm-hmm. But they actually show him driving around town, seeing these flags and crosses, and that scene is, like, completely unnecessary.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things you can do visually that you don't have to then reiterate in words, but I feel like the people here have no faith in the audience to kind of put two and two together as far as a lot of, like, obvious kind of head-butting symbolism like that.
Basically, I would equate this movie to a McDonald's meal in and of itself. Mm-hmm. It tastes good going down.
Oh, wow. But you know
it's not as substantial as you want it to be.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pithy. Yeah. I would agree with that. And yeah, I don't know. It's just kind of goofy. It doesn't commit to anything really. I would say it's vaguely watchable.
Yeah. Like, that's what I mean. Like,
it's not a,
like, if you're in the mood for, you know, this type of movie,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is like a vague biopic thing. Like, it's kind of a paint by numbers movie. It's, it's most redeeming quality is its cast, which
yes,
acts although the I will shit say out of not a lot to work with.
Yeah, they do a very good job. Nick Offerman's fun to watch read the phone book. There's a lot of actors in here who are like that, and I think him and John Carroll Lynch. John Carroll Lynch is one of my favorite character actors of all time. Speaking of David Fincher, he did a really great turn in Zodiac. Yeah, I don't know. It just doesn't really come together. It's so painfully obvious. Like, how many times do they compare, both negative and positive, McDonald's to America?
Oh, yeah. Like, through the whole movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it...
Like, they say those literal words. It's like America. It's like, we get
McDonald's is America.
We get it.
Yeah. I mean, it ends with him meeting Ronald Reagan.
Or
not meeting Ronald Reagan, like getting ready for a
meeting with him. And it's like, okay, you know, we get capitalism, Reaganomics, corporatism, it's all there.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, it also shows, you know, how damaging it is to Dick McDonald and Mac McDonald. But it just never, like, you never really feel like any
that's why
one
I
way
wonder
about
if there was like there was like legally some things they could and could not say or do. Like
I imagine I
feel like because they're using the real company name and logo and all that kind of stuff, although you never see like the full M like you see it now, so maybe that's like one of those like Smallville Superman-esque kind of things.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe it's just like the time frame. Maybe it literally just didn't exist in that form yet, because yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's fine.
Have you heard of Mark film critic, a British film critic, Mark Kermode? He has this term that he calls the chubby moments. And unfortunately, it takes a lot of explanation to say what a chubby moment is. It comes from the Carpenter's biopic from the 1980s, a television movie, where there's a scene where Karen Carpenter reads their first review, and the reviewer mentions something about her being chubby in a paragraph, and she goes, "Chubby? And so whenever he's talking about biopics, he calls anything where the famous person does the thing they're famous for a chubby moment. This whole movie is nothing but chubby moments.
Yeah, but it did make me want McDonald's.
Yeah, and in a way, that kind of undoes the entire message of the movie.
That's true.
I actually feel like Super Size Me, the documentary, even though it's kind of exploitative and on the nose or whatever, I feel like it actually does what this movie sort of sets out to do sometimes. So it also reminded me a lot of that Tim Burton movie, going back to Tim Burton, Big Eyes, which was like amiable and nice, but ultimately a little feckless.
Yeah. If Ray Kroc is supposed to be a villain, which by the end he seems to be, I wanted like a turn, like a Breaking Bad Ray Kroc.
Well, I think the movie sort of aims to be that. I think that in a way that might be the most interesting thing about it is that you start out with this character and you start out with his hopes and dreams, and you see the bootstraps kind of American dream thing sort of poison him. But it never really has. It never does go full Breaking Bad. It never even goes full Social Network with him.
Exactly, and that's what just sort of left me unsatisfied. Like. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I didn't hate it while I was watching it. I enjoyed it fine, but it just didn't really get much out of it.
If it's on halfway on HBO and you happen to start watching it, you'll probably end up finishing it and being like, didn't see this one. But it's not essential.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and get into our Netflix homework then.
All right.
Which is Richard Iotti's second feature, The Double. Richard Iotti, the actor most famously known for the IT Crowd. He was also in that terrible movie, The Watch.
Oh, I was wondering why I knew his name.
You know IT Crowd, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And his co-star in that shows up in the movie as well at the very end. And speaking of Social Network, Jesse Eisenberg is the star as a man named Simon, who's this kind of lonely guy who works in this faceless corporation. He's a cog in the machine. And he feels like nobody notices him. Nobody knows who he is. He's falling for a girl named Hannah that he can see from across the street. He sort of spies on with his binoculars or with a telescope. And, as he's kind of floating through life, this meek and, sad person who can't take any initiative, all of a sudden there's a person in his office and is getting all the attention and accolades and praise and he wish he could get. And then when he finally meets him, they look exactly alike. And Wallace Shawn plays his mean boss. And that's pretty much it as far as like big stars, right? Catherine Moriarty, speaking of Raging Bull, plays a waitress in the movie. I guess it's supposed to be sort of like a surrealist sort of Kafka-esque thing. We talked about this a little bit when we saw High Rise, which has tonally very similar stuff going on. And they both kind of have this kind of
fantasy-like
reality that the movie's kind of set in, this very hyper-designed, very Brazil-inspired kind of look. And
very Brazil-inspired. Yes. Like, there are moments that I think they that were literally just, like, taken from
Brazil. Like, especially, Brazil. Like, the bureaucracy and sort of the plain, like, the way that they depict this kind of, like, machine-like, overbearing society.
Yeah, well, there's, like, the moment when the guy in the neck brace for no reason that's ever explained, like, cuts up his ID card. And I literally think that scene is in Brazil.
Isn't it? Some form or another. There's something like that, maybe. But I also kind of like the hue of the movie, the kind of yellow-green hue and sort of like the junk punk aesthetic. I was getting a lot of Jean Genet vibes. Movies like Delicatessen and City of Lost Children.
It also had a very like German expressionist thing going on, like when he would walk in the courtyard of their weird apartment complex, you'd see these like long bar shadows, you know, strewn across the campus. So it was a little, I thought, a little heavy handed.
Oh yeah, certainly. I mean, the movie is art directed within an inch of its life.
Yeah.
But what did you think of the overall effect?
I just was not into it, really. I mean, to me, this movie was never as good as the sum of all its parts.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, the Brazil stuff was so apparent to the point of distraction for me, because Brazil's one of my favorite movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, okay, I get it. You like Brazil too. I didn't know this, actually. This makes me feel a little bit better. Looking on IMDb, they credit Dostoevsky as the writer, because I guess he wrote the novel. There's a novel version. But Richard Iotti is credited for the screenplay. The movie was sort of over-directed for me. Like, I think maybe had it been grounded in a little more realistic way, the twist with the weird doppelganger might have, it's not a twist, but when the weird doppelganger comes into the plot, I think it might have had more of an impact. Mm-hmm. As it was, I just sort of felt like we were floating in space. Like, there wasn't enough to make this feel real to me. That I just didn't ever really care. I just felt like I was sort of watching like a college student's film. Like, there's just nothing grounding. And when there's just, you know, a character, I like, it took 30 minutes just to even get to the double thing. There's all this pressure put on Jesse Eisenberg's character being, you know, like this passive aggressive milquetoast, not even passive aggressive, just passive.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, I feel like that could have been done more efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
So that when the double comes, like, some of it's meant to be a little fun, but I didn't even feel like it was that fun. I don't think Jesse Eisenberg's a talented enough actor to really play these two characters as totally different. I've seen that done before better by better actors. Like, I think Jesse Eisenberg is fine for what he does.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think he's really got that kind of range. Like, if you want to see a more impressive version of the same effect, watch, Adaptation, Nicolas Cage's Brothers.
Right, right, yeah. Which is not, like, the example you think you would go to compare good acting to bad acting.
Every once in a while, Nicolas Cage surprises you.
You know, Spike Jones in the driver's seat, sure. I kind of just echo everything you said there. I definitely agree with the over direction of the movie and the over design. I felt like the movie was so stylized. Mm-hmm. And so out there from the get-go that you're not only trying to piece together the story stuff, you're trying to piece together the universe building.
Yeah. And so
when you're doing that at the same time, it's hard to get into the narrative aspect of it. So when you get into him meeting his double and you're like, oh, okay, so he's living the life he always wanted to live. Well, what does that have to do with, you know, giant air ducts all over the place and, you know, steampunk weirdness? Like, it nothing really. It's all just kind of window dressing. And it actually kind of, I think, puts too much emotional distance between you and the character. And so I agree. Like, if he just went into, like, a gray, like, office space office with, like, partitions, and that had just been his, like, thing, and like, keep the style as minimal as possible. I mean, you can make it look good or whatever, but, you know, keep the style from overdriving everything so much that, the story stuff would probably be a lot more interesting, actually.
Yeah.
So creatively, I think he saw in this, his vision of it was like, oh, well, it's, I can make this fun and I can make this kind of like this weird kind of, you know, junk punk noir or whatever. And I can, you know, have that kind of quick, repartee between the actors.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, it sort of felt like someone's senior project to me.
Mm hmm. And I really like Richard Ayoade's first movie, Submarine, which was definitely had its influences. Like, he was clearly, like, super influenced by people like Wes Anderson and then, like, French New Wave and British New Wave films from the 60s. But it never lost sight of the emotional arc. And it never, like, it was a good coming-of-age story that had a lot of heart. And mm-hmm. It had a lot of style as well. But the style never, like, drove the story. Whereas this movie, it just kind of got away from itself. It took me way too long to figure out the universe rules to care too much about the narrative rules.
Yeah, which I don't think I ever totally keyed in on the universe's rules. Like,
yeah.
Because at the start, it's very distant. Mm-hmm. And then later on, it gets a little more familiar and comfortable. Like when they're, you know, when they go on the date. Mm-hmm. So there's this weird sort of plot shift in the middle where Simon and his doppelganger James, after they meet, he like is helping James because he's,
which that by the way, what, this date situation, maybe this is what you're going into, and if I'm stepping all over your point, I'm sorry,
but
like that whole setup was so sitcom.
Yes, that's exactly what I was gonna say. It was so like contrived and unnecessary, and I was like at that point I was really trying to figure out what's going on with this double thing. Mm-hmm. Which I think it could have been a better, because it felt sort of like a horror movie near the end. Like, you know, what would you do if this person stole your life and you couldn't do anything about
it's kind of like, it's the sort of Twilight Zone meets like psychodrama kind of thing.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it's based off this old, I mean, just the idea is like this. You know, this old folklore sort of fear of like doppelgangers, of, you know, being replaced. Mm-hmm. And there's different versions of different folklore. Like there's changelings that like will switch with babies and like people whose faces can change. Like there's a pretty strong precedent for this kind of story.
Yeah.
And I think the horror element could have been more effective had just like the rest of the world been normal.
I mean, even like the ultimate kind of surreal, the surrealness of it, of the idea of meeting a doppelganger, whether that's played for laughs or dark humor or whatever, it never really hits with the amount of impact it should because the world they're in is already so crazy.
Yeah. It's like, oh, is this weird? I don't know, because there's a lot of weird stuff going on. The only frame of reference I have that this double showing up is weird is the fact that he's like, that's weird.
Yeah.
and it's even weirder on top of the weird because he recognizes that this guy looks like him. And then he like tries to point it out to people and they don't notice until he mentions it. They're like,
I thought that was funny. There, Noah Taylor, who was also in Submarine, bigger part. His reaction to that, he played that really well, I thought.
He played it well. I just think it's not written well. That could have been better, again, had we been dealing with a more grounded world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I didn't know if it was weird that nobody else recognized it. Like the whole thing just kind of comes off as vague and dreamlike. And even at the end there's a violent confrontation between the two and you find out that they're sort of linked together. And I expected kind of a machinist twist at the end. Because there are references to the character being abusive and an alcoholic or, you know, a drug addict or whatever. And so I thought that I was like prepping myself for some kind of turn to where we would transition to the real world, which maybe could have helped. But it never comes. So you're just sort of left in the same like vague fog. But yeah, even that violent connection between the two characters is never totally explained.
Right. And even though I didn't love High Rise, I kind of felt like a lot of this was kind of done better there. The movie that ended up in my top 10 of the year, The Lobster, is another sort of Kafka-esque dark comedy. And I think that movie explores these kinds of neuroses in a more interesting way. And is stylized without it being overbearingly so. I don't know. I agree with you. It feels like a lot of ideas that don't totally come together. I think there is an ambition here.
Yeah.
I think there's
some cool shots. There's some really fun cuts, which is a weird thing. Like when your cuts are like the favorite thing in the movie. but like when the way he deals with like a character jumping off a building, I thought was fun in kind of a Wes Anderson-y sort of way, but done through like the lens of a German expressionist. So, I mean, there's some technical skill. I think he was trying to do too much with this one project.
I agree. And it's only 93 minutes long. So it really never breathes, and the movie is kind of claustrophobic. Like I like movies that are generally a little bit more efficient and economic.
But I don't think
need
it's
a 2.5-hour movie. But
But that's part of the problem is I don't think this movie's efficient with its mm-hmm. time because I actually, even though there's a lot going on and it does shove it all in an hour and a half, I felt like some of it was really slow and boring for no reason. And I don't mean pacing wise. I mean, like I said, the first 30 minutes of the movie is just driving home this idea that Simon is a loser. Simon is a loser. You know, and I'm all for waiting to reveal the shark, so to speak. But you got to do something with those, with that buildup, you know, like it can't just be hitting the same note over and over and over again. Like I got that he was a loser from the opening when the guy makes him move off the subway seat. Like, you know, we could have gotten to the doppelganger within the first 10 minutes, I felt like.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I don't entirely suggest this movie. It's an interesting curiosity, I guess. But it doesn't totally come together.
Yeah, I mean, if you're having like a Terry Gilliam night.
And you want, maybe. You've seen all his movies. You just want to see all the stuff that that influenced him. Or if you're a big fan of Genet, because I do think there's a lot of that in there as well. But Genet was probably deeply affected by Terry Gilliam. Yeah. I think there's some okay performances. Mia Wasikowska, I have no idea what accent she's doing, but I think she gives a good emotional performance in the movie. Wally Shawn is always fun to watch. Yeah. Noah Taylor, who I already said is pretty good. Jesse Eisenberg, unfortunately, is the weakest link, and he's playing two roles in the movie. Should not be reminding me, like, at this point, Jesse Eisenberg really wants to get away from the Michael Cera comparisons, and this movie reminded me way too much of that terrible Michael Cera movie, Youth and Revolt, where he had a doppelganger.
Oh,
played two roles.
Oof.
So, like.
Ouch. Why are we casting guys like Jesse Eisenberg and Michael Cera to do that? Like. they're the same character through multiple movies, let alone being two different characters in one movie.
And I just want to, I'm a Michael Cera and Jesse Eisenberg, specifically Jesse Eisenberg apologist. I think he should have won Best Actor when he was in Social Network. I think that's a terrific and complex performance. And I think different directors, his stuff with, you know, Squid and the Whale and whatever, I think he can do both comedic and dramatic very, very well. He can also, but I think he is very much as good as a director he's working with.
Yeah. I mean, look at his performance as Lex Luthor, which is
dear God.
So bad. I mean, I don't hate either actor. You know, I think they're fine. Michael Cera, I think, can be a total delight. And Jesse Eisenberg is, he's fine. I just, maybe even casting someone who could be a little bit more grounded, as you know, because Jesse Eisenberg isn't really an everyman, you know, and maybe if we had gotten more of an everyman and someone who could play a bit of a more intense character for the doppelganger, you know, maybe that could have done some of the grounding work that the setting didn't give us. But as it is, we have this setting that sort of floats in this mysterious realm of nonsense, this character that plays too close to type and can't break out of the box, and a story that never totally lets you in on what's going on. So the whole thing just kind of feels murky and
distancing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. What do you want us to watch next week for the Netflix homework?
For the Netflix homework, I chose the documentary Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead, The Story of the National Lampoon.
Yeah, I remember when this came out, and I've never seen it, so I'm interested. Is there anything you want to direct people to? Your Twitter, your Facebook, your...
Yeah, as always, you can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. Tonight in San Diego is back. We're going to do 12 episode run, and then we'll take a short break, and then another 12 episodes, and then a short break, and then another 12. So we're looking at 36 episodes this year.
Did you already do your episode with Chad Michaels?
Yeah. That was our premiere we filmed last night. So that'll air on Saturday. which was mm-hmm. great. Chad Michaels questioned my sexuality on TV, which was a lot of fun.
Chad Michaels from RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yeah, famous the winner.
Cher impressionist.
Yes. She won All Stars and was on season 4 of RuPaul. Cool. Yeah, and it's a really awesome show. We had a fun competition between local radio DJs. Yeah, it is a good time. We started off with a bang. So check that out. If you don't get CW6 San Diego affiliate, you can always check it out on YouTube. And I think that's it for me for now.
Okay. You can follow me at BC Cassidy on Twitter. You can follow the podcast at Jabber Podcast. You can also email us with any questions or remarks you might have about past episodes we've done at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can also follow the show on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast, where I post all of our news stories, and you can leave comments below those if you want to weigh in on something before we talk about it. You can also find us and subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. You can find the archives for the podcast at jabberandthedrone.podbean.com. And that's where we keep our RSS feed. You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also read some of the reviews and content I provided for the Seattle-based entertainment site MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. A friend of the show, Brad Decker, over there in Northern California. I think he's still updating his site, Panel and Frame. You can look at that at panelandframe.com. And friends of the show, Rod and Denise, go listen to their music request podcast at The Listening Party and Denise's new podcast, Mascot Diaries. Both of those, I think they do about twice a month, maybe offset from each other. And friend of the show, Patrick, who frequently writes in and has been on a show a few times, you can listen to his podcast, Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. I know Almost Educational has been getting pretty dark lately because they're, you know, two teachers talking about the future of what's going on with education. We'll talk to you later.
And my new sign out for the podcast, Give It to Gosling.
Bye.